The Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Thursday, May 5th, 2005. The first item on our agenda is House Bill 5043, the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. We are in a public hearing, and we will start with the agency presentation, and I would invite up Susan Isaacs, Executive Director. Good afternoon. We will also be taking any public testimony, and we will also be going into work session on House Bill 5043. We also have scheduled House Bill 5018, which is the Council on Court Procedures, and if we have time remaining, we will take up the discussion of the criminal fines and assessment account, a discussion that we've been trying to get to. I would like to begin the meeting with first a note of thanks to the council, to the Council on Court Procedures. Are those folks present? Okay. I want to say this right at the outset of the meeting, even though we haven't come to your part of the agenda yet. I want to say thanks to the council, to the University of Oregon Law School, the Oregon State Bar Association, and the Oregon Judicial Department for their efforts to keep the council operating during the 2003-05 biennium. We have noted that your combined efforts are very much appreciated by the legislature and very much appreciated by this subcommittee. And additionally, I would like to thank the outgoing chairperson, Catherine Clark. Catherine Clark? You're Catherine Clark. As well as Susan Graby of the Oregon State Bar.
She stepped out.
All right. Okay. Just in time, I will say it again, that we want to acknowledge the outgoing chair, Ms. Clark, as well as Susan Graby of the Oregon State Bar. And both of you have been instrumental in ensuring the continuation of the council, and we extend our sincere appreciation as well to Professor Maurice Holland and Gilma Hemthorne of the University of Oregon Law School for their years of dedication and service and professional support to the council. And again, we wanted to say that at the outset of this hearing with all the members of the audience present to hear them, hear those comments. Thank you very much. With that said, Ms. Isaacs, would you like to direct us to...
I will defer at this time to the chair, okay. Mary Ann Hyland.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to meet with us today to discuss the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disabilities budget. My name is Mary Ann Hyland. I'm the chair of the commission. I'm an attorney member, and I was appointed by the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. And I have a couple of members joining us today. Dick Feeney, he's a public member, and he was appointed by the governor. And we also have the Honorable David Brewer. He's the Chief Justice of the Oregon Court of Appeals. And to my right is Susan Isaacs. She's an attorney, and she's our executive director. And Ms. Isaacs has prepared a thorough memo that's responsive to your questions. And at this time, what I'd like to do is to turn it over to her to discuss the details. And then all of us are available to respond to any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hyland, and welcome. And we thank you in advance for your service as well.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I received a series of questions from Mr. Borden after he had met with you, and I have responded to them with this submission, which I understand he has circulated. The performance measures that we have are in need of a slight revision.
Our first one I've addressed here is number 5. We've hit that 100%. We do review all complaints between the 6 annual meetings, and we find that timely review and resolution of complaints is in the best interest of the complainants, the judges, and everybody involved. So we have been fortunate to be able to keep up with that. Numbers 1 and 2 have to do with responding to telephone calls and sending out complaint packets. I brought some sample complaint packets in the event anybody's interested in these. This information is also available on our website.
Thank you.
And we mail these out. With the loss of staff, we found that sending them the same day or next day became not feasible, and so we send them out weekly. Now, since the meetings are 6 times per year, having that slight change does not in any way interfere with them getting something on the agenda, since the commission is unable to respond to a complaint except at each of the 6 meetings. So I am asking that you modify that somewhat into within a week or 5 days. Number 4 has to do with the length of time for prosecutions, and we are asking for a slight modification there as well. Instead of from the date received, we're asking that it begin at the date of the first review, because of course we have no way of controlling when we receive the complaint. We could get it right after a meeting, and then we're going to automatically have a 2-month lag before it gets reviewed. So we are asking that it start at first review, and then that the time frame go through the commission's recommendations to the Supreme Court. As you are no doubt aware, the commission cannot make final decisions regarding discipline. Only the Supreme Court has the authority to discipline judges. So we had originally in our performance measure the time frame up through the oral argument in the Supreme Court, and of course that's within their scheduling, and we again have no control over that. We have met this performance measure since its inception, even the broader one, but we are asking that it be modified to be more reflective of what we as a commission can control. We currently have 3 prosecutions pending, and again, meeting our performance measures, and timely processing is important for the judges, the complainants, the public, everybody. So we are making an effort to do that. Then number 3, we're asking for a slight modification. I have been fortunate to be asked to speak, and other members of the commission have been asked to speak as well, but to educate others as to the role of the commission. The way it reads now, it's just training for judges, and yet I do speak at the law school in the legal ethics class to cover the ethics of judges to people who are going to become attorneys. And I just this morning was at the World Affairs Council, and this is not the first time I've done that, and it was some judges from Russia who were interested in the commission. So there is interest, and I do speak as often as I can, but if we broadened it to include those other speaking engagements so that they were measured and not just when I speak with judges. So those are 5 measures, and we do our best to meet them, and they of course reflect the commission doing its job in a timely fashion and as promptly as feasibly possible when you're relying upon, you know, the volunteers, because we do have 9 people who come regularly 6 times a year, and then if there's a prosecution, they come to that too. So we heavily rely on their willingness to do this. Are there any questions in that regard?
Questions for Ms. Isaacs or comments? Please continue.
Well, there was a request for a performance measure to somehow quantify the number
research to propose a new performance measure generally related to the percentage of complaints held to be valid by the Supreme Court. I did not find that I could prepare anything that would be meaningful. The number of cases that have actually gone to sanction since the commission began in 1968, there's 14. There have been more prosecutions than that, but sometimes the judges resign. You may recall Justice Fadley in 96 or 98 resigned from the bench, and it had gone all the way through oral argument. So we, of course, cannot track the validity because there's no final resolution. So it just did not seem to be something that we could track or that would be meaningful in terms of the performance measures. And so if you have any kind of questions or further guidance, I'd be happy to see what I could do. But the, you know, the commission reviews all the complaints that come in, and those that have merit are prosecuted. It's nothing to do with numbers. It's simply, did something come in that has merit? And we do, of course, investigate, and I've listened to many tapes of court proceedings to prepare memos for the commission to review at their meetings, and inquired of witnesses and done investigation to assist the commission in making an initial decision. And so it's something that we don't have control over as to whether or not a complaint is meritorious. If it's meritorious, it's pursued. If not, then if it's simply a disgruntlement over the final decision or some kind of complaint, say, of bias or something like that, which is not sustained by the evidence in terms of my investigation, then it's not pursued. So I had some difficulty, but of course we'll respond however you feel is needed in that regard. Now, impact on of reductions. We have taken reductions in the past, and the biggest one, of course, was the personnel reduction. But we're doing okay in that regard. Just I'll refer you back to our need for some tweaking. The educational training has been eliminated, and we certainly do miss that. But the focus and the priority is, as always, the timely processing and review of complaints, and so that's where we focus our money. Now, the commission's meetings are completely confidential. That is statutory, and so the records and the meetings are confidential. We meet in the Portland metropolitan area because about half the members are there. We have someone from LeGrand, Klamath Falls, Newport. We did have somebody from Grants Pass. Now we have a member from Corvallis. Financially, it is more fiscally prudent for them to come to the Portland metropolitan area for a meeting six times per year than for the rest of the commission members to go to an area like LeGrand or Klamath Falls. If we were having public meetings, that would be, of course, a different issue, but that's not the makeup of the commission or the way it works. Now, if we have a prosecution, we go where the judge sits, because venue. Of course, the judges can waive venue. Judge Norblad came to Lake Oswego, and he's from Salem, but you know, if we had a prosecution in Klamath Falls, we would go to Klamath Falls. So you can see how the prosecutions can be an expensive part of our budget. We've been fortunate to stay within budget in the way we've handled them so far. But again, those are wild cards, and we don't have a lot of control over whether a meritorious complaint comes out of Klamath Falls, but we would all go there. And, of course, those are public, so we would have a public presence. So our ability to have a public presence is these educational trainings where I speak or other members of the public speak, and then our public hearings. And then, of course, our website, that's public. And you know, we don't have the ability to determine the number of hits, but I did go through the request for complaint packets, and I noticed a reduction in the numbers that were mailed from the office in 2004, so I have nothing but my own hypothesis that people are downloading these things from the website rather than asking them directly from us. And so the website has been a welcome addition, and we also post the you know, the performance measures and then the annual review that comes out in September and whatnot. You did ask for information about electronic filing, and I did contact the state judicial department would do it for us at a cost of $800, so we could do that. We are to the bone, really, in terms of our budget. We've put forward reductions as you've requested. We have some of these budget numbers, but we have not been using them, like out-of-state travel, because we've been wanting to be sure we have adequate funding to finance our prosecutions. However, there is an organization for judicial disciplinary counsel, which is what I'm considered, and they're coming to Portland, and since there's no housing and there's no travel, and they're probably going to provide meals, so I think I will attend. It's only like, I don't think it's very much money, so they're coming to me this year, and I do hope to attend, and hope that we have money in the budget for that. And also, I'm going to we've been staying really on top of it in terms of supplies and whatnot. And so I'm going to, as I told Mr. Borden, we're going to get a new fax machine because it doesn't work anymore. Are there any other questions about the running of the commission that I need to explain?
Comments or questions for Ms. Isaacs? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, your organization is new to me. So, at a certain time of the complaint or your review process, can you turn over the matter to criminal courts instead of this, or does it always have to go to the Chief Justice?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, if we had a criminal complaint that came in that raised allegations of criminal conduct by a judge, we would be able to, at a juncture where it became public, we would be able to disseminate that to the law enforcement. That has not happened. Generally what happens is there's a criminal complaint, say for example driving while under the influence, and then that comes to us. We're usually the secondary agency that ends up with the information. I haven't seen it the other way around. We really haven't run into this question, but I will tell you that during the course of my tenure since November 2000, we have received information about threats to judges. And even though everything that comes in is supposed to be confidential, we do disseminate that. So it's sort of a public safety type of situation, and we have had instances where we've disseminated that.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that information. If a judge is dismissed, does his pay stop immediately? Do you do anything about his retirement benefits or anything?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisney.
He or her, excuse me, I was sexist.
Excuse me?
I was correcting myself to the chair. I used a sexual term for the judge. It should have been he or her.
The final sanction is by the Oregon Supreme Court. And there have been cases of suspension. In particular, there was one of Judge Gallagher. Let me get my list here. In 1998, and it included no pay. And since the pension, you know, PERS includes the time that you pay in, his PERS benefits were impacted. So when they're suspended, which I have a list here if you have an interest in this list of the cases.
That one especially, thank you.
We have had, since the commission, there's been Judge Skank, 45-day suspension, Judge Gallagher, 6 months, and Judge Norbad, 30 days. And my understanding, I can't speak to Ms. Skank, it was before my time, but that it does involve a pay suspension. And also, I think it impacts, like, health benefits, too. So, yeah, it does impact them.
Madam Chair, which case was that, ma'am?
Gallagher?
Gallagher. Okay, thank you.
Any additional information on which you'd like to provide?
Okay. Sir, thank you very much. The only thing I might add...
Sir, I'm going to ask you to take that seat and move that microphone around and identify yourself for the record.
David Brewer, Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals and member of the Commission, and Madam Chair, thank you for asking. I would only say that as a member of the Commission since 2000 for 6 years, I'm one of three judge members. There are nine members. Three are lawyers in the state bar, and three are public members, that this is one of the most functional and well-operating commissions that I've ever been associated with, particularly given the limits of funds that it has. And I would also just simply share with you this idea. There are a substantial number of complaints that we review during every review period. Many of those, the vast majority of those, don't end up in prosecutions, Madam Chair. And the reason for that, in my experience, is that most of the complaints have to do with disappointment in the result of a case. And the Commission doesn't have jurisdiction over legal dissatisfaction. And unfortunately, in a lot of folks' minds, if the result is one they disagree with, then the judge either was incompetent or perhaps dishonest. And so we get a number of complaints like that usually simply are not supported by the evidence. And so our jurisdiction doesn't extend to those matters. The only other thing I would add, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is that the substantial majority of founder complaints that we get in the Commission relate to demeanor-based issues, where the judge is accused of not having been sufficiently respectful or properly decorous in dealing with people. And the Commission has taken action in those cases. We've had judges reprimanded for that kind of conduct. I'm also the chair of the Judicial Conference every year, and we have a specific educational feature that we try to focus on with the judges at the Judicial Conference relating to the issues that are problem complaints for us. And that primarily at this time relates to behavior, demeanor, how we treat people on the bench. And this Commission takes very seriously its role that judges should behave themselves and treat litigants with respect. And so if I had to say there's an issue that we see more often than not, but not a lot, frankly, it's that issue. So I would just share those thoughts, and thank you for the opportunity.
That's very helpful information, and thank you for coming forward to provide that. Is there additional public testimony on this? Mr. Feeney, did you wish to come forward?
Sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear. I think that our chairman and staff have covered all the material that you asked for very, very effectively. I would note just one thing, and it's a private position and not the position of the commission. Your staff asked why we do not have jurisdiction over municipal court judges, and the response is that the court decided that the law was written in such a way as to exclude the commission from jurisdiction, and that was on a case that came before the court saying that there was no jurisdiction. Well, I am interested that you noticed that, because I personally believe that the municipal court judges should be under the jurisdiction of the commission. The commission, however, is not lobbying on this, nor has taken a position. But since you brought it up, I will tell you what my personal view is that the legislature and your staff were asking the right question, and the concern is registered, and I appreciate that you may be thinking about that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Feeney. It's good to see you in the building. I think it's the first time I've seen you in the building this all session long.
Did bring in some feelings from the past. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Devlin?
Mr. Feeney, you've appeared before legislative bodies for a few years. Former lobbyist for TriMet. Trying to understand this question about municipal judges, would you have to develop kind of a different standard for municipal judges? Because many of the municipal judges that I know are actually attorneys on the outside. So it doesn't seem like they exactly have the same standards in terms of impartiality, and unless they gave up their law practice for the few hours that they're a municipal judge in some communities.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, some of the other members of the commission may want to respond, but frankly, we do have pro tem judges that come under jurisdiction, and they are serving as attorneys, then also are appointed pro tem judges, and from time to time we do consider complaints about them, and the process is gone. I don't believe that there would be any, that particular item would be a problem.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Yes.
So the commission does take that into consideration in the pro tem cases also, in the sense that it's going to be totally, it seems like judges have to be almost separated from the outside world, and a pro tem nor a municipal judge, neither one probably could.
Well,
about judges and
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, and again, my lawyer colleagues may want to respond, but the rules of judicial conduct are fairly strict and fairly well-defined, and I think it's the position of the commission and I think expectation of the state that if you're in a position of a judge, that you uphold those rules of conduct regardless of what some other obligations may be in your career life, that you uphold those. And there are some things that do require some attention on the part of a judge. For instance, there is a sense that judges are held to a higher standard, and I think that's proper.
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, I would add that the code of judicial conduct would apply to every judge that was under the commission's jurisdiction, unless the body that adopts that code makes some sort of revision. So if we were to move forward and assume jurisdiction over the judges that Mr. Feeney has proposed, then what we as it is right now, they would operate under the same code of conduct that applies to state court judges.
For example, and I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair, if my attorney is a pro tem judge, or we'll just use municipal, we'll use pro tem because they're under your jurisdiction. I don't think a pro tem might appear there. Let's go to municipal judge, and you're trying to do this. My attorney, who's a municipal judge, I appear before them on a traffic. That municipal attorney, if they were under you, should recuse themselves. Should they not?
Would you repeat the question, please?
Okay. If you were to apply this to municipal judges, my attorney is the municipal judge. If I, this is not a real case, if I appear before them and I'm a client of theirs, they should recuse themselves from it.
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, I think in that case the ethical code that your attorney is governed by would present a conflict of interest, and in that case there probably would be some obligation to recuse himself.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, just to double-check something, the commission continues to operate without clerical support. Is that accurate?
Right.
Could you speak to us in some more detail about what that means in terms of customer service and being able to respond in a timely manner to questions, concerns, and address complaints, but the customer service aspect.
Madam Chair, I am a 0.5 FTE employee. I also have a law practice. The commission is housed in my law office and has a separate line. I answer the phone. I do have a secretary, but she does not answer the phone. When there was a clerical assistant at 0.25, that was my law office employee at the time, and she answered the phone. We both answered the phone. And, of course, it was very beneficial for the commission because it had a 0.75 FTE, but whenever the phone rang, somebody answered it because there was somebody there. So you basically had two people at 0.75 FTE. So now, since it's just me, and I also have some obligations with my law practice, I'm not always there every time the phone rings. I do, of course, call back. I answered it from there. I call back as promptly as I can, but sometimes I can't get to it immediately. I utilize my legal assistant to help with clerical functions of the commission. I don't. I pay my legal assistant, and if I feel that it's better use of money to have her standing at the copy machine as opposed to me, then that's the way that I do it. And that's what happens. And so between the two of us, we get the complaint packets out to people. But I delegate some of these functions. But since I delegate to her and she has other work, I tell her how to prioritize. So sometimes I do it, but it's just a scheduling matter. That's really what it is. I'm not saying that we are out that far, because I'm real good about answering the phone. Madam Chair, I believe in public service and prompt customer service as part of my law practice as well. So I take that to my state job as well. But just logistically, in terms of sending things out, it just takes more time.
That's very helpful information. Any further questions or comments from the panel? Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is simply because I'm new to this material as well. Does the commission have any function in terms of appointment of justices of the peace, or that function, or how does that happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, justices of the peace are elected officials. And they are elected, state judges are elected, and that goes back to this municipal court judge decision.
Okay.
Municipal court judges are, I think, appointed by their city councils or whatever. I am hopeful that I understand Mr. Borden did disseminate this letter that I sent out in response to your questions, and this is the case. This is right here, the Kino case in August of 2003, where there was a lengthy discussion by the Supreme Court about why the commission doesn't have jurisdiction. But I will tell you that from 1968 until August 14, 2003, the commission had jurisdiction until it was told it didn't. So that is also, I think, responsive to Senator Devlin's inquiry about the code. It's all the same code. Did you wish to?
No, that's. We don't have a justice of the peace. We're in Roseburg, I don't think. So there is one in Canyonville, and that's why I wondered how that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Feeney.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, just to add my understanding of this situation, circuit court judges, pro tem judges, and justices of the peace are judges of the state. And the statute says we have jurisdiction over judges of the state. Municipal court judges are judges of a municipality. No, they are judges in the state, right?
Mm-hmm.
The interpretation, of course, that the court responded to is that they are not judges of the state. They're in the state, and the statute says we have jurisdiction of judges of the state. So there's jurisdictions for justice of the peace, pro tem judges, circuit court judges, so on. But not other judges who happen to be in the state but are not of the state. That's what your counsel discovered.
Well, thank you all for your testimony, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5043 and open a work session on House Bill 5043, the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. Mr. Gordon?
Thank you, Chair Gordley, and members of the committee. On the inside of your notebooks are the LFO recommendations for the commission. Right now, there are no major policy or budget issues associated with the commission. The commission for this current biennium has no budget notes, emergency board actions, or audit findings. And just as a brief overview of the commission's budget, it's 100% general fund. And for the judicial branch recommended budget, which is comparable to the governor's recommended budget, it totals $179,066, of which 56% are personal services, 44% are services and supplies. And it's comprised of one position and one FTE. To pick up on one of the comments by the executive director, is their budget for services and supplies is really has two components to it, normal operating expense and then extraordinary expense for such things as formal investigations and disciplinary actions. So the agency currently does not have any, does not foresee any issues with their budget along those lines, but there is always the potential that they would need to appear before the emergency board like they have historically done in the past if that were to occur. They it has not been since 1998 that they've appeared before the emergency board, and that was for a request for $43,000. That's a brief overview of the agency. If I may, Chair Corley, I'll move into the recommendations.
Please.
The Legislative Fiscal Office makes the following recommendations regarding the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disabilities 2005-07 legislatively adopted budget. The Commission has no policy packages, so there would be one policy package for 801, which would be the standard PERS adjustment that is applied to all state agencies, and this would be the only adjustment to the agency's budget. The agency's budget would be reduced by a third of a percent to $178,497. Furthermore, LFO would recommend that four of the Commission's five performance measures be changed. On performance measure number one, these changes really arise from the fact that they are do not have support staff, and so these are kind of catch-up from past biennial reductions. On performance measure number one, percent of request performs fulfilled, instead of same or next day, it would be within five business days. On performance measure number two, percent of calls responded to the same or next day would be also changed to within five business days. On performance measure number three, number of presentations per year to judicial meetings, and we would recommend inserting conferences and other interested groups, including the state's public and private law schools regarding judicial ethics. On number four, percent of prosecutions completed within 2 years, and the original language was of receipt through oral argument in the Supreme Court, and it would now be, the recommendation would be a change of within 2 years of first review through date of formal recommendation submitted to the Supreme Court. which limits their performance measures to what's in the agency's control as opposed to extending it through a Supreme Court decision. And then performance measure number 6 would be the new standard, which is percent of customer rating satisfaction with agency services above average or excellent for timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, expertise, and information availability. Those would be the recommendations.
Senator Devlin.
This probably goes to our standard discussion on performance measure number 6. Who are the customers? Since the majority of the complaints that are received or they've been identified to us as being people dissatisfied by the decision that's been made in the court, using complainants as customers might yield you some very interesting results in these. So have we defined who the customer is in this particular case?
Chair Gorley, Senator Devlin, perhaps I would let the agency speak to that. We have had discussions, and they voiced that exact concern about how this measure is going to work out. So,
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, it's interesting you raise that question because we've debated it amongst ourselves, and we have many different customers. I think the judges are our customers, community members are our customers, lawyers are our customers, and of course the complainants are our customers. So in defining a performance measure based on customer satisfaction, I think we'd have to give that a great deal of thought and articulate standards in a way that where we could meaningfully measure the customer satisfaction without skewing the results.
Ms. Isaacs.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, another consideration in terms of the customer service is the ability to inquire given the statutory confidentiality of our records. And that's going to be something I think we're going to have to study as well. I did get a draft memo from the Progress Board and about how to do the surveying, and I'm going to have to really study it to see how we could get a representative sample and not in any way interfere with the confidentiality that complainants ask about and others.
Follow-up?
Chair, just to reiterate your concern there, I could see a very clear situation. You receive a complaint that's supposed to be confidential. You send out a rating form back to the complainant. It's opened by somebody else other than the complainant in the household. Have you violated the confidentiality?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the confidentiality statute has been interpreted, at least by the Commission, to apply more to the Commission than to the members of the public or complainants. In other words, if a complainant went to the newspaper, which has happened, we would not go to have them found in contempt due to violation of our confidentiality statutes. So it's more of a people do ask, they do want to be sure that things are confidential, and of course we wouldn't violate that. But it is an issue because the records are so confidential that judges could call and they would say, how many complaints have you had against me? And if we did not ask them for a response, we would say, I can't give you an answer. So we couldn't just go to each judge that had a complaint on the agenda because they might not necessarily know they'd been complained about.
Thank you.
Okay. Does the agency agree with the changes to performance measures as outlined by Mr. Borden?
Yes. It's 6, of course, with the discussion we just had of the problems.
Okay. Senator Devlin?
Did you want a motion, Madam Chair?
Representative Hansen.
You're ready for a motion, Madam Chair. I would move that we adopt LFO's recommendation with a due pass for full weights and means committee.
Representative Hansen has moved that we adopt the LFO recommendations with a do-pass recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee.
And I would also move to accept the changes to the Commission's performance measures.
And Representative Hansen further moves that we adopt the changes to the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disabilities performance measures. Are there any objections? Approved. Thank you so much.
Thank you
again for your work, and particularly to all of the those who provide volunteer service to this agency. We thank you. Thank you very much. And please pass that on to those who couldn't be with us this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, during the interim, maybe we could work on getting it to be the judicial and legislative fitness and disability.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought.
Definitely have to increase the staff, Madam Chair.
Representative, was that?
For Mr. Borden, now we've, this PERS thing that now we're giving, like this agency got $500 back because we think the governor overrated PERS contribution. Well, I'm hearing that we underrated PERS. So how are we going to make all this up?
The governor had to base his budget on a specific PERS rate that they thought would be the rate. Once the PERS board set the rate, they actually set it for state employees a little bit lower than was anticipated. So that's why you're doing all the adjustments.
That's Chair Corley. This is actually a reduction to their budget. So it brings the PERS percentage in line with the new budgeted rate.
Madam Chair. So what rate are we looking at now? I've been hearing 24%.
No, this is... You can give it.
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisden, I apologize I don't have the rate off the top of my head, but I can get that for you.
At the Senate Delaware.
17.7, isn't it?
That information will be coming back to us.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying, Mr. Borden?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5018. The Council on Court Procedures, and I will ask that Catherine Clark, the Council Chair, and Professor Maurice Collin, Executive Director of the Council, please come forward. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Clark. I'm currently the chair of the Council on Court Procedures and attorney in private practice in Portland. I'm going to ask first that Professor Holland speak briefly regarding the makeup of the council, how it functions, what we do, what we have done this past year as basically introductory material. I'm then going to ask our public member, Ms. Nikki Johnson, to speak very briefly, Johnston, I mispronounced that, to speak very briefly about her perceptions as a public member in the last biennium in terms of how the council serves the public. And then I would like to address her budget request.
Excellent. Thank you very much, and welcome, Professor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I understand that you've been on this council for a number of years?
About 15 years, yes. It seems for just another 2 years before my retirement. May I proceed with...
Please proceed, and
you.
Again, identifying yourself for the record.
Yes.
We thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. The name is Maury Holland. I'm a professor at the law school at the University of Oregon, and since about 1991, I've been executive director of the Council on Court Procedures. The council was created by the 1977 legislature as a response to a recommendation of a special commission appointed by Governor McCall in the 1970s to look into any possible shortcomings or deficiencies or areas of possible improvement in the Oregon judicial system. One of those recommendations was that the task of promulgating and then keeping up to date by amendments as needed the civil court rules be delegated by the legislature to a specially created organization which became the Council on Court Procedures. The council began its work in 1978 and prepared rules for approval by the 1979 legislature that became effective in 1980. The reasons for the recommendation for the council was that the trial court rules in civil matters in Oregon had become seriously obsolete. There had been, for example, no merger of law and equity, as there had been in almost all other American jurisdictions. The reason for that was, it was thought, is that very few legislators have any particular interest in or expertise in these matters of civil procedure. I would guess that even among lawyers in the state, probably about no more than 10% are sufficiently engaged in civil litigation as to be expert about these matters. The legislature also, because it didn't work on a systematic basis with the rules, was vulnerable to piecemeal amendments of the rules that would sometimes not fit with the rules taken as a whole. In any event, the council was created. It consists of 23 persons, all of whom donate their time and serve pro bono. These are 12 trial lawyers appointed by the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors, usually pretty much divided between lawyers who represent typically plaintiffs and those who represent the defense, one Supreme Court justice, one Court of Appeals judge, and 8 circuit court, that is, trial court judges, and, very importantly, a public member, Ms. Johnston, who is here today, and you'll be hearing from her a little bit later. Now, what this group does, first of all, I should say that unlike the legislature generally, these are all people, with the possible exception of the public member, for whom the civil rules, the rules of civil procedure, are very central matters in their professional lives because they deal with them every day, either as judges or as lawyers. And they can legitimately claim expertise, as few other people can. And what the council does, to be brief, is after the conclusion of a legislative session, it begins its biennial series of meetings, usually in October following the session, and then meets more or less monthly, occasionally omitting a month if there's no reason to meet, until the December prior to the next legislative session. By that December meeting, the new proposed amendments will be voted on after being circulated to the bench and bar and the public for comment, and will be voted on, and then those that are promulgated and become effective will be reported to the legislature, to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. And the legislature has retained the authority, as I think constitutionally it must, to disapprove, should it see fit, any amendments of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure that may have been made by the council in that biennium or at an earlier time. Fortunately, this has happened only once in the entire history of the council's 25 years nearly of operation. These monthly meetings are at the State Bar headquarters. They involve a fair amount of preparation and a lot of work between meetings by committees that do the preliminary drafting and the research. In addition, the council elects from among its members something called the Legislative Advisory Committee, consisting of 5 members of the council who are available on call by the legislature during a session should any questions arise concerning the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure or civil procedure in general. The sources, where the ideas for new amendments come from. Many of them come from the members themselves, 12 of them, or 10 of them being judges. That's not surprising, particularly the trial court judges are on the front lines every day. And then the lawyer members, too, But the council is very open and does sometimes act on important suggestions that come from non-members, usually lawyers or judges, all with a view to keeping the Oregon rules up to date and as facilitating the most economical conduct of civil litigation that is possible, economical and efficient. In conclusion, I should say that with the diminished, put it mildly, diminished funding from the state and my own imminent retirement, a new phase of the council history is about to open up, which Ms. Clark will talk about in somewhat greater detail, and a new public-private partnership will emerge. But I can assure you that that transition will be a very smooth one. And furthermore, I think the council will benefit from what I understand is a proposed interim legislatively conducted, or at least under the aegis of the legislature, a performance measure review of the council to make absolutely sure that it's doing the best possible job that can be done. And we will continue to have in that transition the very valuable help and support of the Oregon State Bar. Madam Chair, that is concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Holland. Are there questions or comments for the professor? Representative Hansen.
Well, the comment that really needs to be made is to thank you for the incredible service that you've provided to this commission at what I think has been a real sacrifice and. We are very, very honored by the contribution that you've made to the community. It's pretty amazing.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that very gracious remark. I have never thought of it as a sacrifice. There's nothing that I've enjoyed more or learned more from, or my students at the law school have benefited more from my association with the council and the opportunity to learn a lot from practicing lawyers like Ms. Clark. But thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Senator Devlin.
Yeah, I wanted to echo Representative Hansen's comments. We both sat on the committee last time, and we were both very surprised when you came forward and said that I will volunteer my time for the next 2 years to keep the commission alive. It was literally the only one that came before us that said that they would volunteer their time, and it was. It was a very interesting situation because we were very appreciative at that time, and there were a lot of parties within the legislature that made arguments at that time about the importance of the commission. Some of those parties are no longer in the legislature, and I hope there'll be other parties that will. I had just a really basic question. This was established some time ago. But it is still technically, in a sense, part of the executive branch, even though it is so small. Is there any reason, or is it part of the judicial? It's part of the judicial branch.
On paper, and in terms of administration, and I believe where the funding is placed when there was funding, yeah. It's part of the judiciary. Okay. But as a functional matter, it's performing clearly a legislative function that it inherited from the legislative assembly. So it's sort of it's ambiguous, but we sort of understand. We are responsible and accountable to you people because we're doing what you used to do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One of your principal advocates is now the director of the Department of Corrections. So.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Ms. Johnston? Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nikki Johnston, and I am the public member of the Council on Court Procedures. Basically, I'm a citizen who volunteers my time to sit on the council, and I wanted to bring to you more of a business-personal comment about what it feels like to do the job. What Maury was referring to is this book, which has all the rules of the civil procedures in it. And, of course, it's written in mouse print because it's developed over time, and as you go through the process, you have to keep amending it and so forth. I worked in the technology field for 30 years, and therefore, because I was a very early person in the business community in that field, I spent a lot of time in intellectual property. And as you know, intellectual property is the name of the game in technology, and your patents and your copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets are everything. And, of course, you then end up in civil court, either over licensing issues or contractual arrangements on your patents. My interest became quite important to me because I became the vice president of legal affairs with my company. So therefore, every lawsuit, either going out or coming in, I ended up handling. And much to my amazement, some years back, there's this book that I can kind of figure out what's going on. It also helped me become more effective with the attorneys who are going to, say, defend, or in some case, if you brought the suit, become the plaintiff, and you're sitting in front of the courtroom, so you're understanding, so you can become efficient in using, you know, it's very expensive to hire somebody and take them through a patent case. And it was very important to me to understand this, and I was quite amazed to hear this body was in, had been around for a while, and so therefore I volunteered my time. And was I blown away. The committee, subcommittees, if you will, who sit and work out the details of these amendments, worry about the customer, who in that case can be just a company in Oregon, it can be an individual, it can be, you know, somebody from out of state who's having, because the venue is in Oregon, having to come in. And I was very pleased with how thorough the judges would counteract and counterbalance with the attorney's perspective. And I hope that I brought something to the committee as well, saying, you know, all that aside, practically, that's not efficient enough, or it's not going to be cost-effective enough. You're killing these companies. And it was a wonderful feedback. So I wanted to share that with you today, that I am absolutely honored to have had this opportunity. I've had 1.5 terms, and it has been just a pleasure. And I think if the citizens have had the same opportunity that I had to watch it, they would be ecstatic to pay taxes because it is amazingly well run. I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, and we thank you for your time and that endorsement of the work. Thank you very much. Would you like to go forward?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we originally submitted our entire budget as it existed before this last biennium. That was in our original submission, and as the committee is well aware, we were not funded in the last biennium. Our sole source of income was the $8,000 in other funds, which comes from the Oregon State Bar, and was pretty much earmarked for travel expenses. In fact, it was earmarked for judicial travel expenses. I think we're going to exhaust that budget just on spending the necessary funds to bring judges, particularly from downstate. We have a judge from Medford. We have a judge from Coos County. We have a judge from way over on the east side of the state. There's fairly extensive travel involved here. I put a moratorium on any lawyer expenses. So none of the lawyers, and we have lawyers from downstate and from the other side of the mountains, they've been providing their own travel expenses for this biennium. We were told that we had to submit a reduced request, and basically that there would not be any possibility, given the revenue problems that the state experiences, of funding a clerical assistant or an executive director. As you now know, Professor Holland is retiring in 2 years, and that was one problem. And the second problem is that the University of Oregon, which has been given wonderful support to us over the years, is competing also for limited funds and is no longer able to take on the amount of funding that they provided, so to speak, in terms of salaries that they are covering, Professor Holland's salaries, the supplies, the office, the telephone. All of that has come courtesy of the University of Oregon, and they simply are unable to continue to function at that level of support. Given those two problems, I approached, we thought of alternatives here. We thought of Willamette, but Willamette is already providing some support for the Oregon Law Commission. And so I approached Dean Jim Huffman at Lewis and Clark, had fairly extensive discussions with him, and Dean Huffman has stepped forward to fill this gap. He proposes, this would be another public-private collaboration, much like Willamette provides for the LLC. He proposes to provide the executive director, and with no reimbursement until the revenue increases and another possibility is present for increased funding for the council. An executive director who is, he's asked Professor Mark Peterson, who is, was second in command. I think he may now be first in command because the director of the clinic has moved to the Campaign for Equal Justice. He is on the, at the legal clinic. He has been practicing under the rules of Oregon, Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure now for 12 years. So he's very much acquainted with the advantages and disadvantages and the problems. He's very interested in moving forward. He's very enthusiastic. Dean Huffman has also offered clerical support, so that the clerical support would be present in the same facility as the executive director, and I think Professor Holland could speak to the fact that that has inherent conveniences. In fact, distance would be a difficulty. Our original idea was that if the University of Oregon could provide clerical support, Lewis and Clark could provide the executive director. We hashed that one out, and the problem was simply distance and increased cost, quite frankly, for fax and for telephone lines. in addition to the Lewis and Clark proposal, we have asked, we reduced our budget request in view of that proposal and asked for $40,000 in funding. There was an error in that. The original budget of the council had a budget of almost $20,000, $19,284 for services and supplies. We were assuming that that did not include the $8,000 government service charge. We found out afterwards it did include the $8,000. We are therefore in a position to reduce our budget request to $30,000. What that would cover is the $20,000 approximately, and I'm using round figures here, $20,000 for services supplies, including the government service charge, and an additional $10,000 for primarily for travel expenses, because we are very short on travel expenses. And the attorneys from downstate give their time, their effort, telephone communications where necessary from their own offices, sometimes even clerical support for drafting, because it's easier to have the draft come from them than have it come through the clerical support for the executive director. Often that happens. And then they also have to travel at some substantial expense, and they're not getting reimbursed for that. I don't have to travel very far, and I would never expect reimbursement. I live in Northeast Portland. And so all the Portland lawyers have an inherent advantage. And so we would ask for $10,000 for travel so we can have an increased budget for travel expenses, and then, of course, that would pick up potentially some communication charges, too. For instance, I think the Oregon State Bar has stepped forward and taken and given us the telephone connection because some people attend sometimes by conference call. They can't make it over to Portland. And so we have that conference call charge, and it would be I'm grateful to the Oregon State Bar for stepping forward there, but sometimes I wonder how long that's going to continue. They already give us $8,000 in funds. That's therefore what we're asking for. As I said before, only the judges have been reimbursed for travel this biennium. I appreciate the suggestion in the budget note for an interim work group. I think that's an excellent idea. The last time there was a thorough assessment of the council and its functioning and where it could possibly go was in 1993-94. The council was asked by the legislature to conduct a thorough survey of the council's functioning, and there was a fairly extensive report by then-chair John Hart addressing the legislature's concerns, and I would be happy to provide a copy of that letter to you. So it has been done, but not for approximately, at this point, approximately 11 years. Another transition piece has been proposed, and that would be to have Judiciary Committee Counsel provide the clerical services. We understand that this is meant to help and to help the council survive. I would point out that there are certain considerations here and certain problems, and there will be a budget impact from that decision. there are practical difficulties, and I think I've already mentioned them, from the standpoint of the U of O providing clerical services with the executive director being from Portland. There will be increased telephone charges for telephone and fax lines. And there would be, of course, a cost to the Judiciary Committee Council, because any time you're going to take some FTE from other projects, there's a cost involved in that. So in essence, the legislature would be funding clerical services through the Judiciary Committee Council. Now, one other thing I forgot to mention. There is a further transition between Lewis and Clark and the University of Oregon in terms of the executive director. Professor Holland will continue to serve for this next biennium until his retirement. Mark Peterson will come in at the same time so that they will both serve, because there's a learning curve to this process. Professor Holland has 15 years of history that he's going to have to try to pass on as best he can to the new executive director, and this transition will be critical. Secondly, we are trying to work out a collaborative relationship with the U of O. We don't want them to feel that we're turning our back after all of the support that they've given us. So we are proposing several things, and we're working that out now, including law clerk assistance, because it may be that somebody can take for credit, do law clerking for the council, do research, and end up with a paper on a procedural issue. So there's lots of possibilities here that we can do. Collaborative writing a professor from the university and the executive director. So collaborative writing projects will be a possibility, and we are still working out the details of some collaboration between the University of Oregon and Lewis and Clark. We have prepared performance measures for the first time, or goals. We have at this point no data. We've never done this before, and so we are working out some approaches to how we gather data, such as surveys, sending out surveys so that we see if we really, in fact, are serving the needs of the public and the needs of the bar and the Dutch in terms of the work we are doing. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Is it expected that the work group that would function in the interim would also look at performance measures?
If I'm recalling correctly, the proposed budget note that was not mentioned, but I can see no reason why that shouldn't also be included.
Are there other questions or comments? Senator Devlin and then Representative Wisnow.
Question to the analyst. There are no DAS charges to this agency in this budget, right? I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but when you referred to government service charges, that's normally a euphemism for us for DAS charges.
Okay.
So there are no there are no DAS charges in this budget.
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, in the governor's recommended budget, there are approximately $7,500 worth of charges in the agency's policy package that refunds the agency. But
in your recommendation, there are none.
Recommendation, the assumption continues as with this current biennium that state government service charges of DAS would be waived, with the exception of a nominal $300 charge to have a treasury account for the agency.
Madam Chair, follow up, and actually follow up here. You've seen the budget recommendation is $10,000 and $8,000, which is the other funds donation, $10,000 general fund, and you're not paying the government service charges that were originally anticipated, other than $300. And those were anticipated, I believe, in your $30,000 request. What's your reaction to this recommendation is what I'm trying to get down to, seeing the recommendation.
I have. Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I have seen the recommendation. We would like to have some more travel money. If we have to live with this, at least we're funded, and that's an improvement. So I'd have to say it's certainly better than nothing. It's better than the last biennium. And to that extent,
we'd like to see more travel funds, but we can live with this in terms of supplies and the supply budget.
Madam Chair, I'm fine.
Please continue.
Oh, I'm complete, and right. I'm fine with it.
Before I go to Representative Wisnett, I'd like to acknowledge the young women who are present with us. Could you please stand and tell us who you are and where you're from? Well, we're very glad to have you with us this afternoon, and if you're going to be with us a while longer, and if two of you would like to come up and take the vacant chairs, we would love to have you have the experience of sitting with the committee for a short time. We'll let you self-select and come on up. I have a question.
Too scary.
We'll let them work it out. Great, great. This is an opportunity you don't want to pass up. Your future may be in the Oregon Legislative Assembly. Question, has there been discussion about whether there's a conflict in having council locate at a private institution, Lewis and Clark?
There's been discussion as to whether it was wise to move from the University of Oregon and whether we could stay at the University of Oregon. And in terms of directly a discussion about a conflict, I would have to say no, there hasn't been an extensive discussion. I think the collaborative projects between the public and the private entities happen fairly regularly. The best example, because it's the closest to me as a practitioner, is the Oregon Law Commission locating at Willamette. And so I guess with those models, and there are other models, the Oregon Health Sciences University mm-hmm. is a model. So to that extent, I did not at least perceive a conflict that needed extensive discussion.
All right. That answers the question. Ms. Clark, do you have additional information to share with us?
Madam Chair, I think I've reached the end of my prepared remarks, so I'm just waiting for questions.
All right. Then I will close the public hearing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Before we close the public mm-hmm. hearing, I see a representative from the Bar Association. I'm wondering if I could just ask the question of whether or not the bar will continue the $8,000 supplement.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, Susan Grady for the record with the Bar Association, and yes, we are committed to financial contribution to the council and to whatever we can do to continue.
I'm going to ask you to come forward and put those comments on to the record, if you will. Ms. Grady, thank you.
Repeat myself?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, Susan Graby from the Oregon State Bar Association for the record. Yes, the Bar Association will continue to make its $8,000 financial contribution to the council. The Oregon State Bar is very interested in ensuring the continued existence of the council. We feel it serves a very important function in the development and promulgation of rules of court to ensure that it's a cost-efficient and effective process for the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Thank you for that commitment. And again, we acknowledge that all of you have been responsible through your commitment for ensuring that this entity continues, and we thank you for that commitment and for your professionalism. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Wilson.
You forgot to come back to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
But I wasn't going to push it, Madam Chair, because mm-hmm. we've been together too long, because you asked my question.
Right.
But I think that to follow on to that, I'm new to the game, too. Do we...
when you're using private and public putting going together like this is great, but do we need an agreement? Do we have to sign an agreement? There, nothing's required to do that. All these lawyers in house, we don't have to do some work or something to sign agreements to use them.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisman, we do have a letter of agreement that came from Dean Huffman setting forth his commitment. Now, this commitment, and it's a commitment to do this without reimbursement until such time as the state revenues allow a renewed budget request for full funding.
That might be good to put in the record.
It would be very good, and thank you, Representative, for catching that, and we will make sure that that happens. Again, thank you all
thank you
for your participation. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5018, the Council on Court Procedures, and open a work session on House Bill 5018. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to ask you to move the budget notes separately, if you would.
I would move the LFO recommendations for House Bill 5018 is amended to the full Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Borden, I should have asked you if you had comments first.
Not necessarily, Chair Gordley, unless you'd like something for the record.
I would like to speak to the budget note, if you would speak to the budget note, and let's get that into the record. In its entirety.
Chair Gordley and members of the committee, these first comments are general comments of why the Legislative Fiscal Office believes that the budget note is important, and then if I may, I'll read the budget note.
Please.
The council has not been funded with state general fund over the course of the last biennium and several months of the prior biennium. The withdrawal of the in-kind support from the University of Oregon Law School and the Council's consideration of alternative funding mechanisms, including the public and private partnership mentioned with Lewis and Clark Law School, raises some substantive policy issues, which are, you know, what is the most cost-effective manner that Council services can be delivered, and how should the Council be structured and funded in the future. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending an evaluation of the Council be undertaken by this substantive work group with the expectation that the Council will make a formal report and recommendation to the Committee on Judiciary on its findings. The outcome of the work group can then provide a future Joint Ways and Means Committee a substantive base for evaluating a future Council budget request. The budget note languages, the legislative leadership will appoint a work group to evaluate the role, function, and composition of the Council on Court Procedures. The work group will specifically address the Council's continuation as an independent state agency. The work group shall complete its work and make a formal report to the Interim Committee on Judiciary by September 2006. Upon receipt of the report, the Committee on Judiciary shall consider the work group's recommendations when determining whether to propose any necessary substantive legislative change to the Council's statutes for the 2007 legislative session. The work group shall be comprised of the following representatives: at least one member from the Interim Committee on Judiciary who will serve as chairperson of the group, Judiciary Committee Council, Legislative Council, and Legislative Fiscal Office. The work group may also include representatives from the following who will serve as ex officio members: the Council on Court Procedures, Oregon Judicial Department, Oregon State Bar, and the Oregon Law Commission. That concludes the budget note, but as you can tell from the testimony, there are unsettled issues with the Council. There are a lot of options that they are creatively evaluating, so hopefully the work group will serve as the forum to bring to conclusion some of these issues.
I want to make sure that the agency is in agreement with the budget note.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While the agency comes back up, we
we had some conversation about whether or not including the performance measure, and I don't know if you wanted to make that a part of the budget note or not.
Yes. Yes, that would be my desire. And the agency supports the...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the agency does support this budget. No.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Hansen, may I go back to you for a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the budget note recommendation from LFO.
Representative Hansen has moved adoption of...
Then do you want a separate motion on the performance measure language, or
if there's a way that we could adopt the budget note separately, with the indication that we're adding the expectation that the agency develop performance measures.
If I could make a suggestion, Madam Chair, that would
please.
Be that we adopt the budget note recommendations, which are, I'm assuming, have all been approved and by the co-chairs and stuff. And then I could make a separate performance measure recommendation, which would be to that the agency adopt performance.
Very good. That'll take care of it.
So I move the budget note recommendations, and then I'd make a separate motion that relating to performance measures, that the council develop performance measures. In the next one.
That's one motion.
Yeah.
Don't try to chair a meeting on the same day you go to the dentist. That's advice to myself.
I thought you were suggesting to me.
Okay, let's move the budget note first. Go ahead.
Move the budget note.
Any objection? So ordered.
Separate motion, I move the performance measure recommendation.
Any objection? Senator Devlin?
No.
None?
No.
Okay. So ordered.
Madam Chair?
Senator Devlin.
For the sake of the record, did we actually get either consent of all members on the main motion before? To accept the LFO recommendations on the bill itself.
I think that's where we're going next.
Okay.
Move the main motion that we accept the LFO recommendations on the budget with the performance measures and budget note recommendation.
Okay. Any objection? So ordered. Okay. Here.
Can I make an editorial comment?
You certainly can.
I'm just
thank
so pleased that everybody has been able to help us work through this transaction, this transition. This is a real important function, and it can save the public a great deal of time and money, as well as building confidence in the judicial system if people see that the procedures are fair and move well. And then at the same time, if we can shorten the procedures, there's incredible savings both for the state as well as for the people that have to work within the system. So it's real important, and then I'm very pleased with the, I think it's a good fit moving, staying with a law school, that would add a vitality to kind of the whole thing. And I wish hope the transition goes well in the interim.
I think we all echo the comments of Representative Hansen, and I would just add just a personal note. I think it's rather embarrassing that the state is in the position of having inadequate revenue to meet the needs of the commission and the council. I just personally have a little heartburn about that. But again, we appreciate your service so very much and your professionalism, and thank you for being with us this afternoon. Thank you all. I think we are now going to move into a discussion on the criminal fines and assessment account. And Mr. McGee, thank you so much for staying in the wings.
They're serving us. They're going, picking up what we're doing.
My pleasure, Madam Chair.
I think I said that earlier. Mr. McGee, please, where would you like to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. And I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to talk to you today about the governor's proposal on budgeting criminal fines and assessment account during the 2005-2007 biennium. What I wanted to accomplish today was really to give you some background on what the account is, how it works, some history of how the funds have been used in the past, and to explain to you the governor's proposal for how we'd be using them in 05-07. Just a kind of a quick summary to start with. The criminal fines and assessment account includes revenues that are received from the circuit courts that operated by the department, the judicial department, from justice courts and municipal courts, from persons who are convicted of criminal offenses, violations, and infractions other than parking tickets. By statute, a portion of those revenues are transferred to the general fund. That's always been true. The current budget model transfers the remainder of those revenues to the public safety fund, which support a variety of state and local programs. We'll go through what those are, have been in the past, and what we're proposing to do in the future. House Bill 5019 in this session would transfer the entirety of the CFAA funds to the general fund. In the current biennium, 66.35% is transferred to the general fund, and the remainder support the programs. And the governor's budget would shift those programs who have traditionally been funded with CFA revenues from the public safety fund to the general fund and fund them with both general fund directly and with some remaining CFA carry forward that's either at the Department of Revenue or in the individual agency budgets. The next page gives you the history on how the CFA funds have been used. Although this chart begins with the 93-95 biennium, the first column really does cover most of the distributions that were put in place when the legislature adopted this budgetary model in 1987. And you heard some discussion about this during the DPSST testimony. At that time, as you heard, what was then the Board of Police Standards training budget was funded this way, and about 20% of the revenues went to the then BPST. Other things that were funded were also law enforcement functions such as state police training, state police operations, some communications equipment, but there was a variety of additional functions that were more or less law enforcement public safety funded here. The impaired driver program at the Department of Human Services, the children's, well, this is a little bit later, but the also Department of Human Services alcohol and drug abuse programs, operation of the State Marine Board, Parks and Recreation Department operations, and driver and motor vehicle service operations. So really from 1987, when this model, budget funding model was established, it was used for a variety of different programs in addition to directly law enforcement and public safety. And I guess the last point I'd make in terms of the initial distribution model was that in 1987, the general fund portion was 58% of the revenue. So it has also always very significantly been used to support general fund programs as well. Over the years, the legislature, as you see, has taken programs in, has taken programs out, almost biennium to biennium. The Children's Trust Fund went in. It's come out again since then. Emergency Medical Enhancement Fund was established several years ago that would both fund the Oregon Poison Center, which is funded in the current biennium with some CFAA revenues. It provided some training and equipment to rural areas for emergency medical trauma and services. So over time, we think this has been a very fungible revenue source in terms of how the legislature has used the money. Page 4, I'm really not going to spend a lot of time on. I just wanted to give you a sense of kind of what this model looked like, because it is one of the more complicated funding models in the state. And believe it or not, this model was created in 1987 to simplify things for the judiciary. At that time, there were all kinds of different ways money was coming in from folks who were convicted of fines or from offenses or crimes or infractions. And it was very difficult from the track the revenue. So at the top of the page, you see the defendant's court judgment, the single financial obligation. At that time, the legislature said, okay, anything that was owed as a result of a conviction would constitute a single payment that would be made to the judicial department, and it would be distributed in several ways. So category one are straight compensatory fines to victims, and those are paid 100% until whatever fine is imposed by the court is fully paid. The next two categories, restitution, and category three, which is a whole bunch of different things, and I'll have a little more of a summary in a minute. The criminal fines assessment account is where category three flows to. Those are paid 50-50 until both of those obligations are paid off. And finally, there's a category four, which is county assessments, local split of fines, state intoxicated driver funds, and some reward program. And those are paid at the end. You following down the middle, you see the category three information data goes to the Department of Revenue for the circuit courts. It goes to the Department of Revenue for the judicial and municipal courts. It goes directly to the judicial department for the circuit courts. There are some initial distributions that are taken. The Department of Revenue retains some administrative cost chargebacks. There's a distribution for the law enforcement medical liability account, LEMLA, in the Department of Human Services, and the intoxicated driver program in the Department of Human Services. What's left over is the criminal fines and assessment account monies that you look at from a budgetary standpoint. There's a little bit that's taken for child support payments out of the general fund side, but then the distributions then become either to the general fund or to the public safety fund. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that gets made in a minute. Page 5 shows you where the revenues come from in terms of the different actions that at least the circuit courts take. We don't have this kind of detail for the municipal and justice courts, but it does show you where the revenues flow from the circuit courts. 56% of the revenue that flows into the CFAA are fines. 23% is what's referred to as the unitary assessment, which is an additional fine upon conviction that in the past has often been used synonymously with criminal fines and assessment account. It really only constitutes about 23% of the revenue that goes into the fund. Other revenue sources are indigent defense recruitment, the domestic violence assessment, bail forfeiture, security deposit retainage, court costs, miscellaneous issues. So this really shows you kind of the distribution of where the state dollars come from. The next page shows you the history of the actual revenues that have flown into the CFAA since the 1997-99 biennium. You see there was a significant jump in 97-99, and there were some legislative action, I think, that caused that. But since then, it has been a pretty flat revenue source, about $112 million, a little bit of a drop in 01-03 during the worst of the recession period. But overall, we seem to be seeing about the same level of revenue from biennium to biennium, despite the fact that, you know, we do have some areas, DPSST particularly, where the demands on the revenue source have continued to grow. The legislative history here, from 1987 till really the 1999 legislature, there were specific distributions and percentages in statute for particular programs. For example, the DPSST operations program got 19.XXXX. It went to 4 decimal points in statute for the percentage distribution of the revenues. And each revenue source, each distribution was in statute, and when the legislature wanted to change that, it did require a full statutory change, not just a budget action through the Ways and Means Committee. 1982 went beyond that to add maximum dollar cap so that it was X percent of the revenue source up to a total dollar amount of whatever, and the transfer to the general fund was increased. At that time, the legislature limited the ability of courts to reduce or waive assessments. It was felt, I think, accurately, that there was some situations, particularly at the municipal and justice court areas, where the fines were being waived inappropriately or disproportionately, not advantaging the state. So there was some restrictions placed on that by the legislature. The Secretary of State was authorized to audit circuit justice and municipal courts to assure compliance, and did in fact, when they audited that, found that by their estimation there was about a 600,000 plus understatement in the fiscal year they were looking at of revenue that should have flown to state from appropriate application of the law at that time. During the 2103 interim, there was a legislative executive work group that reviewed the CFA distribution model. Senator Gordley, you were on that at one point. Senator Schrader, Senator Westland also participated on that. And the result of that was House Bill 2877 that eliminated the statutory distributions, the percentages, and the caps, and created a budget model for allocation of CFA revenues to the general fund and programs. So that would be the responsibility of the Ways and Means Committee to take a look at this biennium and determine how that works. And I'll have a little graphic here in a second that shows you how that model works. But the statutory criteria for use of the public safety fund said that the legislature should allocate money in a priority order. Number one is public safety training, standards, and facilities. Number two is criminal injuries compensation, assistance to victims of crime and children reasonably suspected of being children of crime. And number three was the emergency medical enhancement account programs that had been established at that time. There was also a proviso basically that said debt service needed to be paid before any other expenditures were paid. So with that statutory model, slide 9 really shows you in a graphic sense how this works and how the Ways and Means Committee deals with it. And there's really sort of a series of actions here. The first is to make a determination of what the percent is that goes to the general fund or to the public safety fund. And that's the first thing you'll do. That if this biennium would be included in House Bill 5019. Once you've done that, assuming that there is a transfer to the public safety fund, there would be specific allocations to programs in 5019 of the revenue. And then there would be, in the individual agency bills, expenditure limitation established to allow the agencies to spend that money. If this sounds very similar to the model that you use to allocate lottery fund resources, it is, because that's what it was based on when the work group did that. The history of this in the 2103 biennium, the first time we used this model, 70.35% was allocated to the general fund, with the remaining approximately 30% to the public safety fund. Current biennium, 66.35% was allocated to the general fund, the remaining to the public safety fund. And the governor is proposing that 100% of these revenues be distributed to the general fund and 0% to the public safety fund. And slide 11 really talks about the reasons why we did that. First reason is, in truth, CFA revenues are basically completely interchangeable with general fund. The first slide I showed you, the uses over time, make it very clear that the legislature have used it for public safety purposes, human services purposes, natural resource, transportation. It's been used at different times for different areas. And beyond that, when you have a situation such as the increases in DPSST for the debt service, for the expanded police training course, for the operation of new facilities, under the current model, if you're going to increase funding for a CFA program, you are almost certainly going to decrease the revenue that flow to the general fund. So even though you have an appearance of other funds here, you really have an up and down dynamic that says if you're going to increase this program, you're going to cut the general fund. So we look at these funds as pretty much general fund under a different name and thoroughly interchangeable. Our second consideration is that the recent history of flat revenues and growing programs have required agencies to submit reduction packages and fight for restoration. basically, when we believe that to begin a biennium, when the legislature has established a percentage, say 66-33% that was established in 2003-05, when agencies begin to build their budgets for the 05-07 biennium, as a whole, under legislative direction, we maintain that two-thirds, one-third split between the general fund and the public safety programs. Given the increase that we're seeing, particularly for DPSST, but also the inflation increases that you would expect to see for the other programs, there wasn't enough money in that 66%, that 33% split to be able to fully fund all the program growth for all these programs. As a result, the agencies have to submit reduction packages and then policy packages to ask for restoration of the budget back. You saw that back in the DPSST budget where we had some large reduction packages and then restoration packages. In the past, in the current biennium, DPSST, as a result of this dynamic, was reduced by 9%. The Department of Justice victim compensation programs were reduced by 6%. The state police training by 28%. Basically, what we see is that kind of the other funds' decisions within this model are made out of context with the general fund decisions, even though the revenue, for all intents and purposes, really truly is general fund. So what we're looking at then is to try and get the decisions made in context together, as we believe they appropriately should be, given the nature of how the revenue stream works. The next issue that we talked to you about before is that if you maintain this as an other fund revenue, there really is a need for a cash balance for these agencies. It's a cash balance for two reasons. One is just the normal cash flow needs that any organization has over the course of a period of a fiscal year or a biennium. The second is that other fund agencies need to be able to finance their compensation increases that are bargained during the biennium out of the cash they have. As you know, there's $130 million in the governor's budget for compensation needs for general fund agencies. Other fund agencies have to be able to retain a sufficient revenue balance to pay for whatever salary increases and benefit increases are negotiated in the biennium out of those revenues. Moving DPSST back to an other funds issue would mean that by our calculation you would need to add $1.9 million of that revenue specifically for cash balance to deal with the cash flow needs and the compensation increases. That's $1.9 million under a general fund model you'd be able to spend for programs. And our final issue here is we believe that funding public safety programs with revenues that are received from fines and assessment creates the appearance, not necessarily the truth, but the appearance of a conflict of interest on the part of criminal justice and law enforcement agencies to the extent that it appears that their enforcement actions can increase funding for their programs. And we believe that's something appropriately avoided. The last couple of pages just give you some of the information that's in the governor's budget. The bar chart here just shows you the increase in allocation from 2003-05 to 2005-07. You'll see the very large increase in DPSST's debt service. You'll see the very large increase in its operations, slight increase in the memorial fund, and then decreases in very many of the other agencies, state police training, the Department of Justice programs, the Department of Human Services Domestic Violence Fund, the Sexual Assault Victims Fund, the Medical Services Fund. And the Poison Center is basically fully funded at the same level in large part because it was carved out of the OHSU budget as part of the governor's proposal there. The last page just gives you the numbers here, and it shows you the resources that are available in 03-05 and 05-07. You'll see in our proposal that kind of in that middle column at the top that we're proposing the entire $111 million be transferred to the general fund. There's about a $500,000 carry forward from 03-05, so that's public safety fund dollars that are available for allocation. And then at the bottom you see where the allocations are. In the farthest column on the right shows you what the percentage change in allocations were from 03-05 to 05-07. That's kind of a very quick and explanation as to why we believe this is an appropriate way to allocate these resources in the future, and I'd have to try and answer any questions.
Madam Chair,
is that one, when we talk about the 1.9 reserve funds that the department would have to have in comparison to the 130 million that the governor has for the same purpose? Now, could we either reduce the governor's amount to 1.8 to find the 1.9? Or are those two numbers roughly proportional to a proportional relationship between the two of them in terms of
I think the fact that there would be, I mean, that we would be, if you leave the general fund in these agencies, we would be funding the compensation increases directly out of the $130 million. The issue is you wouldn't have to necessarily worry about the cash flow needs of the agency, and we would be funding more appropriately based on what is negotiated rather than a guess at this time as to what we negotiate.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I believe the 1.9 is made up of two components. The compensation component, which is probably a one-to-one if you give 100%. Past biennia has never gotten totally to 100%. The other issue is cash flow, as Mr. McGee mentions, and the distribution of CFA revenues in statute don't make those dollars collected through the CFA system available until the 2 or 3 months into the
biennium. It's a quarterly distribution.
Yeah, so you don't get it all. You don't get what you need on day one. You have to wait until, you know, day 90 or whatever it is. And you have to have enough money to pay payroll and other costs to that point.
And there are significant fluctuations during the biennium on a month-to-month basis, ups and downs. I mean, there are, for some reason, there are better months and worse months. So there really is. Doug put that better than I did, but we do have the two issues.
Senator Devlin and then Representative Hanna.
The one, the portion that would have to be reserved because it's another fund source, appears to me to be some degree probably prudent, but still simply a practice that in other fund sources we make this reservation because of how the funds come in, particularly in this case because they come in on three-off cases. But I guess the bigger question that I try to ask, and I guess the governor answered it in his recommendation, is whether I make a permanent change in policy to free up $1.9 million. And that's still a very difficult decision, and I don't think it's one that I would ever make, and I don't think the governor made it lightly either. But I think the problem that many of us have, at least those that us that followed this for several bienniums, is that once this funds become entirely fungible, just like general funds, what priorities will some of these programs have, like domestic violence programs, sexual assault programs, other programs that are here? I can go upstairs and I can talk to the majority leader in the Senate, who has promised at one time that they would move the Children's Trust Fund from CFA to general fund and just trust them, and the next biennium it was not funded. You know, it's just basically, I don't worry as much about that tie between law enforcement and the fee, because I like the tie between victims programs and criminal fines and assessments. I think that tie is really appropriate. So it's still a difficult decision for me. Mr. McGee, you made an excellent presentation, but I'm still not convinced.
Madam Chair, if I could actually address that in those areas. I understand your issue about the balance issue, and I think if that were the only concern, we probably wouldn't be making this proposal. Although, truthfully, there almost certainly will be there will be increases in health costs, and there likely will be an increase in salary that if there isn't a balance left for these kind of agencies, they'd have to cut programs to be able to afford. And you're right, that's a policy choice. Again, agree with you that when you move these programs to the general fund, they do compete with other programs. On the other hand, I would make the argument, and I've been working with this revenue source since 1995. It's sort of one of my curses that I can't get anyone else in my office to take. I'm convinced after looking at this that these programs actually do worse in this model than they would under a general fund model. It's true the Children's Trust Fund did not come back into the general fund. I think we could have a long argument as to whether the state should be funding one agency whose primary purpose is to raise to raise to be a fundraising agency. That's another issue. So I think the issues really, in terms of that this truly is general fund, we believe we ought to call it what it truly is. And the difficulties that these programs have had being dealt with as other funds programs off here by themselves, I think have hurt them more within the way this revenue model works than they would be if they were in the general fund. You heard the analogy in the DPSST budget the other day of how the state police were protected when they were in the highway trust fund years ago, and not thinking about when they were taken out. But part of the reason they were protected there was because the uses of that fund are protected constitutionally. And you couldn't have the type of movement of funds into all the different sorts of uses that the legislature has used these funds over the years. You really can't use the trust fund. So a dedicated funding source, I think, is not necessary to protection that intuitively we might think it is. I think there are some very counterintuitive aspects of this fund source.
Mr. McGee, I agree. I think you made a nice presentation about this, and I, too, like the senator, am not convinced that this is exactly right. And I guess the flip side of your argument would be some funding or haven't been treated quite as well versus zero, still rather have some funding. And that's kind of the case that we're looking at here. That would be the tough part. And, you know, I just look at, you know, for example, the Department of Justice, criminal injury piece, domestic and sexual assault programs, the Memorial Fund, Medical Enhancement Fund. None of those, in my mind at any rate, fall under the same comparison of public safety comparison where we might, you know, there might be a perception of conflict of interest. And those that are funded in there, you know, might legitimately, especially if you are a victim, you might feel pretty good that your funding was coming from that dedicated piece. And I, too, like the senator, worry that when you take this away and you put little teeny tiny fish in a great big pond, it may become predatory, and that's a tough one.
Representative Wisnack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would amen, but last two statements, I support keeping it like it is. Can you tell us, both co-chairs put $1.6 million back in. The governor's cut these 10%, your priority two programs, basically all 10%, but both co-chairs have put in 1.6. I didn't add it up. Does that restore the 10%?
I haven't added either.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, it is a $200,000 cut in DOJ. You would have needed 1.8, I believe. So this subcommittee will have the honor, or the subcommittee similar to this will have the honor of distributing that the $200,000 cut among those four programs, most likely.
Even with the co-chairs' addition?
With the co-chairs. It would have been 1.8. They both put 1.6 back in.
That's 200,000.
Yeah.
Mr. McGee, thank you. I know that other questions will surface. I have several, and if you could contact my office and schedule some time, I'd like to visit with you. Appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Beckman.
He got me closer, but he didn't. It was the best I could hope for. Thank you.
Representative
Hanson. Excellent presentation. Just has one constitutional problem.
Yeah, I understand that.
Colleagues, I do need to back up. I need carriers on the two bills that we approved on the House side. Representative Hanson, would you be willing to carry the Council on Court Procedures? Representative Hanna, the Commission on Judicial Fitness?
Madam Chair, I'd be willing to split them with you. Whichever
you.
One you want, I'll
All
take
right.
the other one.
I'll do court procedures as you'll take. Thank you very much.
Just start loading up for Senator Winters.
She's here in the morning. You give her that to do.
Yeah. And she's 35 now. Colleagues, thank you very much. And I appreciate your indulgence in the chair. And have a great afternoon.